welcome to yet another edition of Comfortably Unnumb. My name is Blake Anderson. I am the programs manager here at the Umbrella Society. I'm also the host of this podcast, coming to you today from the traditional unceded territories of Lekwungen-speaking people in beautiful Victoria, British Columbia. So I told everybody that I was going to get a podcast out within 2 weeks, and it's been almost a month. I'm really sorry about that. You know, there's just been so many new and exciting things going on at Umbrella that I think a month just, you know, swept right past us here. But I am happy to be back, and I'm so excited to have our next guest on this program. I have a woman by the name of Stephanie coming on this program, just an absolutely wonderful human being with quite a story. Stephanie is an employee with us and has had a wealth of experience in this field. And I've been trying to get Stephanie on this program for about a year and a half. She was very reluctant at first, but I knocked on her door again and just, you know, tried my hand at getting her on the program now. And she was really receptive and willing to do so. As I've mentioned in the past, and I'll probably continue to mention, these are deeply personal and intimate stories that people are coming in and sharing. So it takes a great deal of courage and vulnerability to do that. So I really appreciate Stephanie's, you know, change of tune and, you know, really being okay with coming on and sharing the story. I think it's an absolutely brilliant story. And I also love Steph's perspective, because not only, you know, is she coming from a really strong personal recovery, Steph has been working in this field for so long and has such a great insight on the climate of, you know, our community right now and what's needed and what she sees out there. So just the, you know, really perfect person to have on. Steph has been working, like I said, with Umbrella for a long time. She's worked on our encampment team. She's worked in our sites. She does our women's recovery group. She runs our smart recovery program. And now she's jumped into outreach full time, both on Salt Spring Island and here in the city. So Steph is just, you know, such a great role model and advocate for folks getting into recovery. So she also has a wealth of experience working at our place with our homeless population, Salvation Army, her time on the encampment team through Umbrella and Island Health. Really gave her just such a great glimpse into, you know, what's needed with our street community. So I'm just so excited to pick Steph's brain and to hear her story as well, which is really profound and like I said, is, you know, quite the story to tell. So thank you, Steph, for having the courage to come on here. Steph, everybody. Okay, Steph, thank you so much for coming on. I have been wanting to get you on, I think, for almost a year. And I remember you being a little apprehensive at first about doing this. So I just want to say right off the bat, I really appreciate you having the courage to come on. And I know I've been bugging you more than once about this. And the second time you were just really eager and really willing to come on. So I appreciate that so much.
Well, thank you for asking me.
Yeah. And, you know, for me, you're just such a perfect candidate. I think you're such a perfect spokesperson, you know, and role model for women in recovery, not only, you know, because of your personal recovery, but the work that you have put in this field, the breadth of experience. And I know we'll kind of dive into that. And I know I explained a little bit in the intro about, you know, all you've done for, you know, our community, not only through Umbrella, but through, you know, your work with Our Place and your work, you know, in Smart Recovery and the program. And so, yeah, I think this is a really great opportunity to share your story. I actually don't know a lot about your story. I feel like I know you quite well now, but, you know, we haven't, you know, dove into that aspect, you know, of your life. So, yeah, I'd love to hear a bit of a backstory. Could you kind of, you know, take us back? I always like to kind of hear, you know, where substances and where addiction kind of first started showing their face for you. And it's up to you how far you want to dive back. But yeah, I'd love to hear kind of, yeah, what kind of got you to that point of recovery.
Okay. Well, I mean, my dad is an alcoholic. So, I mean, I guess I can remember as far back, the first time I ever tried alcohol, I was 7.
Oh, wow.
And I remember I was at my grandmother's. And I remember coughing for like 20 minutes after I had taken, I don't even know what it was. Right. And, but yeah, there was always alcohol in the house because my dad drank. Right. The first time I ever got drunk, I was 13. And I kind of, at that point, it was kind of like I found my solution to all my problems.
Okay.
You know, at 13. And, you know, I kind of felt like it was the easy way to just kind of deal with the fact that I had an alcoholic father. But I really didn't know a whole lot about alcoholism either. My parents separated when I was 11. And the biggest problem was the alcohol. And I always knew my dad as somebody that drank beer. You know, there was no, to me as a kid, there was really no issues. It was just somebody else.
Normal.
It was normal. I grew up in a small town and called Shawnigan Lake, and it's just outside of Duncan. So we lived in a trailer park, so most parents drank. Right. So it wasn't uncommon. It was very familiar. And I moved to Victoria with my mom and my younger brother. He's 3 years younger than me, after my parents had separated. And I moved back up with my dad when I was 13. And, you know, the alcohol was present all the time. And I really didn't start to notice the behaviors with my dad's drinking until I was closer to 15. Okay. And but for me, it was kind of when I got drunk that first time, even though it made me sick, I just felt like there was like this sense of relief, like, okay, there's my solution right there. I can see why drinking's present.
Right.
And I think it was probably closer to when I was about 16, I started to become more isolating where my home life was concerned. There was a lot of behaviors that didn't make sense to me. I started spending a lot more time down in Victoria with friends, but there was always alcohol present. And I remember always looking forward to Friday nights.
Okay.
Because I would travel from where we were living up island and go down to Victoria.
Right. So this was like your time to get away and just kind of let loose a little bit.
Yeah. And it was just, it was just another escape away from my home life. And I just remember always feeling like I was walking on eggshells every time I went home.
Okay.
And I was probably grade 11. And, you know, so it's like Friday night, it's like, okay, I'm going to take the bus, or a lot of times I would hitchhike. But I was going down to hang out with my friends, and we would either smoke pot or we would drink. And
so substances were kind of synonymous with that kind of, you know, freedom, getting away from your situation, kind of alleviating all your, and so up until, you know, 13 to 16, you were just kind of, this is a weekend thing, and it was still a weekend thing when you're 16 at this point.
Yeah. But, I mean, it was
constant, you know, fairly consistent weekend.
Yeah. I think, you know, between 16 and 17, it was like every weekend I would go down to Victoria. And it was, for me, it was great, you know, and I mean, I didn't think that my drinking was problematic. I was just like any other 16-year-old kid that just wanted to experiment with alcohol. But it was more so about how it made me feel.
Okay.
And it was like, it took the edge off. It was just a way of escaping. And I didn't feel like I was walking on eggshells. I was just having fun with my friends. And that probably went on for probably, you know, even right up until I got married and had my first child. Okay. You know, I never drank during my pregnancies.
How old were you at that point?
My son was born when I was 21.
Okay.
So not long before my 22nd birthday. My drinking was not problematic. Mind you, the first time I ever went to the hospital was when I was 19. And
okay.
I ended up with alcohol poisoning. I ended up being hooked up to heart monitors and IVs because my blood alcohol level was almost 5 times the legal limit.
Okay, so this is just a big night.
Yeah, it was a big night. Yeah.
Right, okay. Right.
Yeah.
Was it worrisome at the time, or was it just like,
I just kind of pushed a little bit too much. Okay. And, you know,
so
it was kind of
no big flags for you at that point.
No.
Yeah.
It was just, okay, I had too much to drink. And I mean, I was back drinking probably a few days later. And that's what I did with my friends, you know, like it was just like a social thing and I didn't look at it as problematic. I mean, my mom was extremely worried because she was called to the ER because my friend took me to the hospital.
Right.
So the biggest concern at that point was my mom's concern for me. Mm-hmm. And my son was born when I was almost 22. And I just remember my son was colic. And I remember being at home, and it was a long night. He didn't sleep well, and neither did I. And I remember stumbling across a bottle of wine that had been from our wedding day. And I'm like, oh, maybe I'll just have a glass of this. You know, I'm just going to take the edge off because...
Alcoholic babies, that is a huge, right? I mean, like, nonstop, right?
That's relentlessness. Yeah. And I thought, okay, you know what? I just need to take the edge off because I was really stressed. And that was like, but it was almost like I had gone right back to that first time I got drunk. I was like, right. There it is. There's my solution.
There's your sanctuary. Almost,
yeah.
Right?
And so, I mean, and even then, there were periods of time in my early years of my marriage where, my drinking was concerning, because I just felt like I was constantly going to the alcohol. And, you know, I had two kids after that. I didn't drink throughout my pregnancies, but it was like, the pattern was like when I wasn't pregnant.
You didn't have to stop drinking. Yeah. You were drinking.
I didn't have a reason to stop drinking, and I had a reason to drink when I wasn't pregnant. And, when I started to notice my drinking becoming really problematic, was probably, I always knew that we drank a lot, like more than most people.
And was your husband kind of, you know, along the same lines as you? Was he the one kind of raising those concerns with your drinking, or was he kind of along
the same? He was, yeah. He was starting to raise concerns a little bit, like, you know, you're drinking a lot. But it was never really much of a concern for me because we drank together. So it was kind of, well, you drink a lot, but then it was kind of like, okay, well, we're just drinking together. So I didn't see it as a big problem. I knew that we drank more than most people, but we had friends that drank just as much as we did. So we always just kind of, you know, hung out with them more often just because there was no questions or concerns, right. And there was no comparability to anybody because we were all just having fun drinking.
Right.
And then... I guess it must have been 2011. My husband and I had separated. I moved out and got my own place, and we shared custody of the kids.
How old were the kids at this point?
At that point, my youngest was 5, and my oldest were 8 and 11. So we shared custody. And I just kind of, I figured that once I moved out and I left my marriage, that things would just, that was my solution. It was like, okay, this isn't working. I'm just going to move out and we can share custody of the kids and we can kind of co-parent. And for a while, my drinking started to lessen a little bit, but it wasn't very much long after where I started to notice that my drinking was starting to become more frequent.
Okay.
And in between 2011 and 2013, my husband and I at the time were kind of hanging out again and trying to figure out how we were going to be able to make things work. I ended up moving out of that basement suite, moving into a different one. And my drinking started to become more heavy because we were starting to drink again. Like we were just going back to what was comfortable.
Right. Okay.
And, at least that's for me anyway. That's kind of how I felt. I was like, okay, this is familiar.
Right.
You know,
right.
And it's like, okay, so let's try and maybe we can get back together. We can try and make things work. So
it's kind of almost part and parcel to repairing the marriage.
Yeah.
Essentially. It was, right.
Yeah. And it wasn't really repairing the marriage. It was just going back to old behaviors and doing the exact same thing, which is why I left to begin with.
Right.
And, you know, we had financial problems and all kinds of other added things that happen when you're in a marriage. And, but my solution was always alcohol.
Right.
It was like, okay, so if we're drinking, it's dealing with the marriage problems, but it wasn't dealing with anything. It was actually masking the problem and it was making things worse.
Right.
But I still didn't see my alcohol as the major problem.
Right.
It was, okay, the marriage isn't working, so it must be the marriage.
So you're looking at
every other option I could think of.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And we got back together in 2013 and things were okay. We were trying to work through some things and trying to figure out how to do things differently. But there was always the presence of alcohol. And I remember it was Christmas of 2013 is when I started to feel like there was a mental and emotional shift in my behavior. My drinking was starting to become more secretive. I was starting to hide things. I was starting to isolate from people. I wouldn't come out of my house. And I just started to feel like I was overwhelmed with like anxiety and depression and all of these things that I hadn't experienced before. But again, my solution to numbing anything was just to drink. It was like, okay, if I just drink, then it'll just go away.
So instead it's compounding all of these.
It was,
right.
Yeah. So it's, we moved out of the complex in 2014. But just before we ended up moving out, I ended up in the hospital. I had taken a fall and I went headfirst into the ground. Luckily, I didn't hit the cement, but I hit the ground and knocked myself unconscious because of my drinking. At that point, I had been put on antidepressants and I was taking some classes down at AOT. And
so the addiction outpatient, the treatment down on Quadra Street in Victoria.
And so at that point I knew there was a problem. It was like I knew there was a problem, but it wasn't alcohol. I was like, if I can just fix all these other things, then I can drink. Then the alcohol's not the problem. It was more me trying to convince myself that I can still drink and not have all these problems.
Right.
Not realizing that my drinking was creating these problems.
All the problems, right.
And I wasn't working through anything. You know, I was putting up walls everywhere. September of 2014, I went to stabilization the first time.
Okay. So obviously, you know, you're starting to have some interventions. So like AOT, you know, so you were saying you weren't feeling like it was the alcohol that you were there. What were you telling yourself was the reason why you were going to a place like AOT?
I thought, okay, I just need to figure out why I behave the way that I do.
Okay.
You know, and why my brain operates the way it does. And maybe I can learn how to change the way I think about life. But I didn't want to change the way I thought about alcohol because in my mind, alcohol was my solution to everything.
Near and dear, right.
Yeah. And it wasn't something that I was willing to let go of either. I'm like, I want to hang on to this solution. It was like a backup plan.
Gotcha.
And so I went through every course that they have down there back in 2014. Right. And a lot of that stuff was very, very intellectual stuff. But it didn't pertain to alcohol. Like I was like, all this stuff makes sense, but why can't I stay sober?
Right. Okay. So you could apply this to other aspects of your life,
but not my drinking.
Right. Interesting. So what got you to decide like stabilization and, you know, stabilization is a 30 day stay and kind of, you know, with accountability and needing to stay sober and.
Yeah.
What kind of got you to that point where you was someone else telling you, hey, maybe you should consider this, or was that your decision?
Yeah, no, I had a counselor down there and, so I was working with her and I wasn't ready for inpatient treatment because I didn't think that I really needed to go to like a 60, 90 day treatment program.
Right.
I needed a break. I just needed a break from life, get things organized and then I can kind of go back. And I was trying to find ways of normalizing my drinking.
Right.
And I thought, okay, I'm going to go to stabilization in 2014. I'm going to go through this 30 days. It'll give me an opportunity to kind of just let the dust settle a little bit. I can get myself into a routine. And I was excited to go. So I was there and I had a routine, but it wasn't long after I left, I relapsed.
Right, okay.
And at that point, I didn't really understand this whole relapse thing because
you hadn't given it an opportunity.
And I didn't understand the whole AA thing. There was no way I was going to consider myself an alcoholic.
Right. So when you were in stabilization, were you starting to do, you know, AA or were you, you know, yeah. obviously you're getting some, yeah, there's some expectation for you to do groups and, yeah. and whatnot. So you're starting to kind of see the different interventions out there, but it wasn't completely resonating with you at this point?
No, my idea of being an alcoholic, it was, I thought being an alcoholic would be like what I experienced in my teenage years was, you know, what I saw as somebody that was an alcoholic was my dad. Mm. And because of a lot of the things, all of these behaviors, and I always told myself, I'm never going to be like this person. Mm. So I never wanted to label myself as an alcoholic, but I was like, and so the whole idea around AA just kind of weirded me out.
Okay.
And I was like, I thought it was almost embarrassing to be like, I have to go through a 12-step program to learn how to live.
Right.
And I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. I'm perfectly okay with living.
Right.
The truth is that I wasn't. Like, I wasn't living. I was just kind of going through the motions in life and hoping that they would just work themselves out.
Right. Okay.
And so I went to stabilization in 2014. And then we ended up, in the process of all that, we were moving out to Langford.
Okay.
So it was a lot on my husband at the time, where we had the three kids that were getting into schools. He was having to do all of that work to get them into the proper schools and work full time. And then he also had a wife that wasn't at home for 30 days. So I came home, and it wasn't long after that I started drinking. And I think at that point, when I started to question my drinking, like, this is a problem. Like, why am I drinking so much? Like, it was to the point where if I was numbed out, I was better off because I didn't feel anything. And it was like all of the guilt and all of the shame and around my drinking and the disappointment with my kids too.
Right.
You know, that I started to realize I was becoming somebody that I didn't like anymore. Okay. And so there was a lot of guilt and shame around, you know, like, what happened to me? Like, why am I here?
Right.
And not understanding how to cope differently.
Right.
So it was, you know, the guilt and shame around my drinking. And then it was the guilt and shame around how it was affecting my family. Mm. And the only coping strategy I had was to be in oblivion about it.
Right.
So then I didn't have to worry about it. And I just made matters worse. And in 2016, I left my husband and my kids. At that point, in 2016, when I had made the decision to move out, I wasn't in any position to be looking after my kids. Right. I was a train wreck. And I moved in with my dad and my stepmom. And my dad was sober at this point.
Wow. How long had he been sober for?
I think he had been sober for, I believe it was about 8 years that he had been sober at the time that I moved in.
Hmm.
Ballpark 8 years, I think. Yeah. And he was my biggest advocate.
Okay.
Because he was sober. But I didn't know this sober dad. I had stopped talking to my dad for about 6 years because of his drinking.
Yeah.
And his behaviors. And so my kids didn't really know him when they were younger.
Okay.
So when, you know, when my marriage fell apart, and at that point, I think my oldest, my son was done. He's just like, you know what, if she moves out, thank God, because I'm tired of it. He was 16.
Right.
Just before his 16th birthday. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he was, you know, and I, you know, and for my kids too, it was like, you know, like, what happened to mom? My kids were like my best friend, and, you know, they lived in my back pocket, right, you know, right up until my drinking became a problem, and I was no longer mom anymore.
Right.
And so when I lived with my dad and my stepmom, like, the requirements were, like, if you're living here, you're not drinking.
Okay.
You can't drink here.
Right.
I did not follow that rule. And as a result, I was asked to leave.
How long did that take?
I moved in July, and it was probably the end of November.
Right.
You know, and, you know, my dad tried, you know, he's just like, you know, you need to start looking at this as, you know, this is a big deal. Like, right. You know, like now your marriage is falling apart, you know, and I mean, and I didn't take full responsibility for marriage falling apart. You know, there was other aspects involved, you know, and in a marriage, it takes more than just one person. But my drinking was what basically ended it.
Right.
And me leaving. I had so much guilt and shame around my kids. And every time I looked at them, I'm just like, I need to leave.
Right.
Like, they don't like me. And so, you know, all of these things that I was telling myself and, you know, and I thought, you know, they're better off without me. Mm-hmm. So living with my dad, it was a different experience because now I'm living with my dad many, many years later. And he's sober.
Right.
You know, and I was angry at first with him being sober.
Really?
Because I was like, why couldn't you have gotten sober back when I was a teenager? Sure. This is what was going on in my head.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, but really, I mean, he was supportive. He was there for me, but he didn't support my drinking. Like, he was just like, you cannot drink here. There's no alcohol in our house. And, you know, at the time I was like, okay, you know, I'll respect that rule. And I didn't. But I just kind of went from one place to another. I didn't have any coping skills. My go-to was I was drowning my own pain with alcohol.
Right.
And so I moved out in November. I ended up staying with a friend and that didn't last. But it was like now my drinking brought me to a place of being homeless.
Sure.
You know, I had people in recovery I'd stay with and they're like, you can't stay here if you're drinking.
Right.
So I ended up staying at a woman's shelter for 30 days in 2016. And I stayed there for 30 days. I went to a transition house for a week because there was nowhere else for me to go. I was on the list for stabilization again.
Okay.
And so I went to stabilization in December of 2016 and I kind of carried on through there another 30 days in stabilization. Then I ended up going to live with my sponsor at the time because there was no second stage. I didn't have the funding for it.
Right. So you were just in for the 30 days and there's no other real option. So you're trying to find the safest solution.
After stabilization. I knew I couldn't go back. And I wouldn't have gone back to my husband at the time.
Right.
I knew in my heart that my marriage was done.
Okay.
And it had been over for quite a while. You know, it's not like we didn't try.
Mm-hmm.
But with the alcohol being present and how it was deteriorating me, our marriage had just fell apart.
Okay.
And I knew that in my heart. Like, I knew that I wasn't going to go back. Because it wasn't healthy. I would just go back. I would just do the same thing. It was just going back to another toxic situation.
Right.
And I had created so much damage at that point where my oldest didn't even want me there. Okay. Like, he's just like, Mom's not moving back in the house or I'm moving out.
So there's these firm boundaries in place all of a sudden. Right.
Yeah. So I moved in with she's my friend now, but at the time she was my sponsor.
Okay.
You know, she's like, you know, you don't have the option of, you know, Lilac House or Holly House because I didn't have the funding for it.
Right.
Yeah. At that time, I was on income assistance. No, not income assistance. I was on EI. Okay. I had to exhaust EI first. And I didn't have enough money to be able to pay. I mean, I know that Schedule H paid for my stabilization, but they wouldn't cover Lilac House.
Which is just bizarre, right? You're actually sitting here going, I want a safe, sober place to live in. Sorry, you just can't. Yeah, the funds won't.
You know, funds are not there.
Right.
You know, my husband at the time didn't have the extra money to be able to shell out because he was taking care of the three kids.
Right.
And so I moved in with my friend Stacy, which was my sponsor at the time. And it was the same thing. She's like, there's no drink in here.
Right.
You know, and that lasted about a month.
Okay.
You know, and I did the same thing.
And was it kind of just this slippery slope, you know, was it a little bit at a time or did it just kind of, as soon as those floodgates are open for you, you're right.
Yeah. Now? It was just kind of, you know, if the first month I was there, it was okay. And I was going to meetings and then I would just get this idea, like I'm doing okay. I'm feeling better.
Right.
You know, and it's like still no coping skills.
Right.
Going to meetings, I still didn't really understand the whole steps and really so honestly.
Kind of going through the motions.
I did not want to do the steps.
Okay.
To me, it just didn't make any sense. I'm like, I'll find a different way. Right. Well, my way got me loaded every time, you know, and again, you know, I'm back in stabilization 2 weeks later. And from that point, I went to treatment.
Okay.
So I went
so
to
the different.
Yeah. I'm like, okay. And I was dead against going to treatment too. I was like, oh no, I don't need treatment, you know? And at that point, by the time I got to that place, I was like, you know what, maybe treatment isn't such a bad idea.
Right.
So I went to Pacifica and I was there for 90 days. And I loved it.
Great program.
It was a great program. Yeah. And I went to meetings and I connected with people and I made friends. And I started the running group. And it was great. It was, you know, it was just like, okay, you know, like I'm starting to feel like I've gotten my life back together. Right. I'm starting to do the things.
Just enough time, too, to really see that.
Yeah.
Progress.
And so I was there for 90 days. And then I moved back to Victoria. And I was living in Sydney. In a second stage house.
Okay.
And it was great for about 2 weeks. And then I just started going to hang out with the people that I used to hang out with before. I didn't know anybody in Sydney. But in my mind in treatment, I'm going, you know, I really need to stay away from Langford. I really need to find a different area of town to live.
Okay.
So it was great that the second stage house was in Sydney. I didn't know anybody. New meetings, new opportunities, new connections. But it scared the shit out of me.
Right.
I was like, I don't know anybody here.
Yeah, this is brand new territory.
Yeah. And rather than recognizing that I actually was the one that had made a lot of changes in 90 days, I was focusing on how nobody else had changed.
Interesting.
So I was like, even the people that I hung out with, I'm like, these people haven't changed.
Right.
But it was not I wasn't looking at it like I was the one who changed. Everybody was still living their lives, doing what they were doing. And it was uncomfortable for me. So I started to slide back into old behaviors, hanging out with the same people, not staying in Sydney and going to Langford and doing things pretty much the same way. I just was repeating the same cycle. You know, I'd do well for a while and then I'd relapse. And I had a lot of relapses.
Okay.
And I just wasn't ready to get sober.
Right.
I was like, okay, I've done treatment. But in my own mind, I'm thinking, there must be something wrong with me.
Right. Well, and I mean, I think that's so common though, too. You know, you've gone, you've put in these 90 days. And I think that there's always this misconception that treatment's going to solve all of your problems.
Well, and that's what I thought.
And I think there's, such a letdown when you come back and life hits you in the face and, oh, it's still there. And hey, that actually didn't stick that first time. I think that's got to be a huge letdown, right?
Well, I was disappointed with myself. I'm like, after I drank and I'm like, I just threw away 4 months of sobriety.
Right.
But even though I was in a treatment center for all of that time that I had, I wasn't applying what I learned in treatment in the real world.
Right.
It's like, this is where I really need to do the work.
Yeah.
And I just, I was like, okay, you know what? I've got 4 months.
Right.
I can drink. Right. I can have one.
Right.
You know,
so the old justification just starts coming right back.
And I was just like, and then I'm right back in the same situation again. And I'm just like, okay, now I have nowhere to live because you can't drink in a second stage house.
Right.
Apparently in a sober house, you can't drink.
Right.
And so I ended up leaving there. I ended up back in treatment.
Did you go back to Pacifica?
Nope. I went back to Hannah. I went to Hannah House.
Okay. So this is the interventions. Okay.
So I was discharged from Pacifica July 14th, and I ended up back in treatment September 23rd of the same year.
Okay.
So I remember I had a girl that went through Hannah House 5 years prior to me going, and she, I remember her telling me, go to Hannah House.
Right.
It's a hard program.
Right.
She said, it's an AA boot camp for women.
They run a tight ship.
And I was like, when she told me that originally, I was like, I'm not going there.
Right.
So I went to Pacifica, but then I was like, you know what? Maybe that's what I really need. Maybe yes. I really need
kicking the ass.
Yeah. Like, you know, but it was like that, the ruminating these thoughts of like, there's got to be something wrong with me. Like, I must be a failure.
Right.
And so that didn't really sit very well with me either. You know, it was like, I'm doing all of this work and I feel like just an absolute letdown and a disappointment. And so I went to Hannah House and I completed the program. And, you know, I didn't really look at it like it was an AA boot camp for women. I actually really enjoyed being there.
Okay.
So I completed the 60 days. I ended up staying for 111 because there was no spots in second stage.
Sure. Okay.
So, and I thought, well, you know what? I'm in a safe place.
Yep.
You know, I can still do programming. And I was able to come to the island and see my kids.
Okay.
And when I went through the program at Hannah House the first time, my son had made the decision he didn't want to talk to me.
Okay.
He was just done. Sure. You know, it was too much for the kids, you know, just constantly being let down and disappointed. And at that time, my oldest daughter had made the same decision, like, until you get better, right. I can't talk to you. Like, it's too hard to watch you do this to yourself.
Sure.
So I completed I ended up going to second stage January 1st of 2018. So I had been sober from mid-September right up until I went into second stage, and I stayed there and I was sober for about another month, and then I did it again. Another relapse. And at that point, I had been on my way to the island. And when I showed up on the island to meet my mom and my youngest daughter, I was intoxicated. So that visit didn't happen. My mom basically said, you need to get back on that ferry and don't come back to the island. Right. The island is not good for you.
Yeah.
You know, this is the second time you've done it. You need to go back there and do some more work.
Right.
And stay there. And I had made the decision that I was going to stay in Maple Ridge anyway.
Okay.
But it was it was really, really hard. Because I was still living with that, the guilt and shame around, like, who I'd become, you know. And, you know, my youngest daughter was my little buddy, you know. Right. And she was young. She had just turned 11 not that long before. And, my relapse was February 9th of 2018. And at that point, I had nowhere to go. I ended up going back to Maple Ridge, and I started packing my stuff because I actually didn't relapse in Maple Ridge. It was on my way to the island.
Okay. It was right.
Yeah. Right. So when I thought, but in my head, I'm going, okay, well, I'm not going to get caught because nobody's around to see me.
You can have enough time.
I'll have enough time, but I didn't, right? I had enough time to get intoxicated. And so that didn't work out at all. I ended up going back to Maple Ridge. I started packing my stuff, but there was a part of me being surrounded by the women in this second stage. I'm going, I need to be honest. Mm-hmm. My sponsor said, it's not my place to tell anybody that you've relapsed, but if you live with that secret, eventually it's going to come out.
Sure. Yeah.
And I knew that
too. Right.
You know, so I was sitting upstairs in the living room on the couch, and I gathered all the ladies that were there. And I said, listen, I said, I'm packing my stuff. I said, I relapsed on my way to the island and I need to go. And one of the girls that was there had said, you need to leave the house and we'll call Hannah House and notify them. And then we will pack the rest of your stuff and then you can come and pick it up later.
Yeah. Yeah.
And at that point, my sponsor and her partner picked me up with all of my belongings and drove me to Abbotsford, which is where I was staying with a friend that I went through treatment with.
Okay.
And so I stayed there for a couple of days and that didn't work out because I did the same thing.
Mm.
You know, again, I've relapsed. I'm full of guilt and shame and, you know, just creating problems everywhere I went, you know, for not just for myself, but for other people. You know, I wasn't thinking about other people. And I finally ended up getting a place in Maple Ridge. And I lived with this woman in a condo. And I really liked living there. But at that point, I had given up with trying to get sober, stay sober. I just thought, that, you know what, recovery's just not for me.
Right.
This
You've
is
tried
just,
enough times.
Yeah, and yeah. I failed every single time trying to get sober. I've gone to treatment now twice.
And it's so hard not to look at it as a success and failure, right?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, is, I had just damaging. Got to that point yeah. where I gave up.
Right.
I'm like, you know, I might as well just continue to drink because obviously this is what my life's going to be like,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it was, you know, my kids weren't talking to me. My youngest one was still talking to me. My kids weren't talking to me. I was losing friends.
Mm-hmm.
One of my really close friends that I went through treatment with was setting boundaries. Like,
right.
I can't spend
so,
time with
so
you.
Everybody is, yeah, needing to set their boundaries for their own self.
Yeah.
And for your sake too, right?
So, you know, when I tried to go back to meetings and I just didn't feel like I had it in me anymore. And I thought, okay, well, you know what? I don't know what's going to happen next, but I'm not going back to treatment. I'm not going to, I shut the world out. I was like, I'm not going to AA. I'm not going to treatment. I'm not doing any of this work because I've tried it so many times and it doesn't work.
Right.
So.
And I think that's that piece that's, you know, so challenging when you have worked so hard at something and it hasn't,
yeah.
you know, stuck. I think that's a really, you know, hard place to be. And also, but it was there a recognition, you know, a thought that, you know, all the work that you put in was all for nothing. You know, because I think I've seen that so often where it's like, you know, that work is foundational work.
Yeah.
It isn't going anywhere. But the thought at the time is like, well, if it's not working, then it's kind of all for nothing.
Yeah. And that's kind of how I felt. I'm just like, I don't even know why I bother.
Right.
You know, and my relapse lasted from February until June.
Okay.
And, you know, June 7th of 2018 was the last time I drank.
Okay.
And it was that day where I was literally at a crossroads. And that's when I made the decision. I either save my life or I'm going to die. And I ended up detoxing on my bedroom floor for 5 days without medical care.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what brought you to that decision? Was it, was your body starting to?
My body was, well, I had a lot of health problems even in 2014. They were starting right. to question, like, you know, your liver is not very happy.
Yeah.
You know, and back then I was like, okay, well, I'll just, you know, I'll stay away from alcohol for a little bit and then I'll be fine. Like, it's just the insanity around addiction.
Yeah.
You know, like your body starting to shut down,
mm-hmm.
You know, and by the time I made that decision, I remember calling detox and they said it was going to be 6 weeks before I could even get in.
Oh.
And back then, you know, compared to wait times now, 6 weeks was nothing.
Right.
You know, and I remember them calling me and saying, yeah, it's going to be at least 6 weeks. And I'm like, I'm going to be dead by then.
Right.
You know, and
that is a long 6 weeks.
That's a long 6 weeks.
Ready to make a change.
Yeah. And I finally made that decision. I'm like, you know what? I'm either going to drink until I get into detox and hope to God I don't die, or I stop drinking right now and get through the detox and then figure it out from there and hope to God I don't die.
Mm.
And on day three of my detox, I thought to myself, what am I getting myself into?
Right.
You know, and I pushed through it. But the only thing that was on my mind while I was going through withdrawals was, if I don't get through this, my kids are not going to have a mom.
Mm.
So yeah, at that point, I went back to a meeting and I put my hand up and said I was coming back to the program. And I called Hannah House the next day. I called the call center and they got me in treatment in 2 days.
Wow. You know, that's what I love about that program too, is how quickly they can actually act on, you know, getting that help.
Yeah.
2 days. Okay.
2 days. I remember calling and Kaylee had said, hold on a second, let me call the office. And she got back on the phone and she said, be here at 1 o'clock on Thursday.
Okay.
And that was Tuesday morning I had called.
Man.
And yeah, the manager basically said, get her in here before she ends up relapsing again.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back to Hannah House on Thursday, and I haven't touched alcohol since. Man. It was just, I had a sense of relief when I got back to that treatment center. Because I was so grateful that I did not die of a heart attack or a seizure. Absolutely. Like anything could have happened. And I was alone.
Yeah. Right.
You know, the woman I was renting from was an LPN. She worked 12 hours a day. Sometimes it was like days on end. So she would just stay at work.
Right.
So I was, it was me.
No, I guess you wouldn't have a doctor to kind of give any medical intervention at all.
It was and just, I didn't want to call the ambulance because, you know, I didn't want anybody to know what was going on.
Oh my God.
Yeah. What so it was a scary 5 days and I just, I went back to treatment and it was a sense of relief. I'm like, just like, I made it. I'm alive. Mm-hmm. And it was like a game changer for me. It was like everything changed at that point. I just let go. I was like, I am so done trying to fight with alcohol because I am losing every time I try.
Right, right.
And I went through that program and I went to second stage. I did the training at InterVisions. Like I just kept
You just went into it, right.
Yeah, so I just did everything different.
Right.
And I remember I had been 3 months sober at that point when I went into second stage. And I was on FaceTime with my youngest daughter and my son got on the phone.
Wow.
And he said, when you come back to the island, would you want to go for coffee? Wow. I was like, wow. I hadn't talked to him for a year. And I was just like, anytime I tried, he was just like, nope, I'm not talking to her.
Yeah.
And I don't know what changed. I don't know what was different. And at that point, it didn't matter why things were the way they were. They were just the way they were.
Okay.
And I'm like, I actually have an opportunity to visit with my son that I hadn't talked to in a year. Mm-hmm. And And in my own mind, I'm thinking, is he going to talk to me about all the things that I've done wrong, you know, sure. There's ruminating in my head that it's going to be all about me. And it had absolutely nothing to do with me.
Right.
And, I went through the training and I was working at the One Way Club, which is it's like the Alano Club over there. Okay. I got a job there, did some volunteer work, but I surrounded myself with recovery.
Right.
I was literally, I stayed in the middle.
Diving right in. Yeah.
And I remember the second day I was at Hannah House this last time, and I really wanted to go to a meeting. And you're not supposed to leave grounds after 72 until after 72 hours, but they let me go to this meeting.
Hmm.
And I remember seeing somebody there, and I was very intimidated by her. And I remember somebody in the program told me early, if you want a good sponsor, pick somebody that scares the shit out of you and ask them to go for coffee.
Okay.
So that's what I did.
Wow.
This girl was covered in tattoos, had like fingernails that were like 4 inches long. And I was so intimidated by her. But I remember being at her 1 year cake and thinking to myself, she has something I want.
Mm.
And that was the first time I had ever experienced wanting something that somebody had and was willing to do the work to get it.
Right.
Okay. You know, and I just thought her story reminded me of my own.
Right.
And so, I asked her to be, I originally just asked her to go for coffee. So she met me at meetings until I got off restrictions.
Okay.
And then she did my step 5 when I was in treatment. And then she became my sponsor.
Wow.
And I'm so grateful that she was my sponsor because I did not have any wiggle room whatsoever. She called me out on everything.
Amazing. Yeah.
But that's what I needed.
Right.
Like I needed somebody to keep me accountable.
Right.
And I didn't want to do things the same way because I got tired of the feeling around the end result of doing the same thing all the time.
Right.
And so I went through the program. I went into second stage and I was at second stage for 6 months. Okay. And then I moved out. I moved in with a lady that rented to people in recovery. She was 25 years sober. And so I lived with her for another 4 or 5 months. And I got my 1 year, My daughters came to my 1 year. My son couldn't because he was working.
Right.
So my mom and my aunt and my daughters came to my 1 year cake.
Oh, amazing.
And yeah. And so things started to really shift with their dad too. I had originally asked Christmas of 2018 if I could have the kids. He wasn't open to the idea at that point because he was like, you know, what happens if something happens and I'm not there? Because I was still in Maple Ridge. And it was like my shift in thinking of why is he not letting, you know, like, why is he not giving me what I want to, you know what? He's not ready to make that decision, but he's open to the idea of coming over and making some other arrangements.
Right.
And so it was March or April of 2019. They were going to come over and spend the weekend with me on the Easter weekend, but they chose to stay in Victoria. They came over the May long weekend. I took them to Playland.
Okay.
So it was like that first experience. Like it was like, you know, this is what recovery feels like.
Right.
It's no longer about getting what you want. It's about working to get the things that you want.
Right. So you're actually walking the walk this time.
Yeah.
Right. You're actually,
yeah. I'm not making all of these mistakes and, you know, creating trust problems. And then, yeah, I took my 1 year cake in June and I moved back to the island in August of 2019.
Okay.
Yeah. And my first, when I was in Maple Ridge, I was working at the, I got offered a job at Hannah House, but I didn't take it. I really wanted to work with the homeless population and work with that community.
Yeah.
I remember sitting in the Sandy Merriman when I was in 2016, I said, one of these days I'm going to help these people. I couldn't help myself.
Right.
But I knew it was like one day.
Some vocation calling.
Yeah. And so I was working at the Salvation Army for 5 months. So I worked with the homeless community there. And I didn't really understand much about the harm reduction stuff. Like I really didn't. I knew it was there. And, you know, the terminology for harm reduction with some of the folks, it just, I didn't even know what it was.
Right.
So that was my introduction to harm reduction because I just knew recovery is recovery.
Right.
You know, harm reduction, it was like my whole headspace was, what do I got to do today to stay sober?
Right.
And my sponsor was a bit concerned because I'd only had 7 months at the time I had started working there.
Okay. Yeah. So still early on enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I just knew that I had no desire to drink. I was like, I am so done with that life.
Right.
I had experienced homelessness and the fear around it. And I'm just like, I just don't ever want to, I want to be able to help these people. You know, and be there for them and support them in their journey and just meet people where they were at.
Right.
And I loved it there, you know. And then I moved in August of 2019. I moved back to Victoria. And I got my position at Our Place Society, working in the seasonal shelter.
Right.
And I kind of carried through with, you know, working with the homeless community and learning a bit more about harm reduction. But working at Our Place, we didn't do any of the harm reduction stuff there.
Right.
You had to go to like the harbor and stuff like that for all of that, the supplies and stuff.
Supplies.
You know, and I just never really understood the whole idea around it. But I made a lot of great connections, like in the community. And
your role is to connect and provide support, and
yeah, and just meet people where they're at with no judgment and stigma. Because I mean, I lived with the judgment and stigma around addiction.
Right.
You know, and it keeps people there.
Right, absolutely.
Right, like we have enough shame and guilt as it is, as alcoholics or addicts. Right. We don't need any more. And I created great connections with people. You know, I was never, you know, I wasn't one of those people that wanted to harm anybody. It was just, you know, like if somebody came to me wanting help and it was like, what can I do to help you today? Like, what is it that you need more than anything, right? Like a lot of the homeless community is just about meeting their basic needs.
Right.
Right.
Absolutely.
You know, and so I worked with Our Place for almost 4 years. But I also, in the process, was working for Umbrella.
Yeah. So you kind of came into the picture with Umbrella and starting off, you know, more on a casual basis. And then you seem to, it seemed like every opportunity that came up, we were like, what about Steph for that one? I wonder if Steph would be. So I feel like we kind of slowly and surely got, you know, starting to do, you know, groups with us. And you got involved with our, you know, Smart Recovery. And and I think we got to pull you over when we had a program for you here with the encampment team. Mm-hmm. So that was our first
real
full-time gig over here.
Yeah. So when I first started with Umbrella, which was in 2020, it was full-time.
Mm-hmm.
But I was carrying two full-time jobs, which is not really highly recommended. You know, it's just addiction in a different form. I was like working way too much. And so I ended up going down to casual for a while with Umbrella, and I still worked with our place. But I started to find that the more I focused on just, you know, the community with harm reduction, that I wasn't focusing on my own recovery. Right. So it was like getting into Umbrella, which was a goal of mine right from like 2014. I had gotten Evan as an outreach worker. Right. And I was like, you know, one of these days I'm going to work for them. You know, because, you know, the Umbrella Society was such a huge part of my recovery.
Right.
You know, being able to just have a very neutral connection with somebody that's got lived experience. It wasn't a sponsor. It wasn't somebody taking me through the steps. It was just another human being walking in recovery and meeting me in the community to have coffee.
Right.
And I always, like, at that point, it was like, I really want to be, you know, it's like leaping. I want to be an outreach worker right away. But I just knew that I wasn't ready for that yet. And so when the encampment position came available, because I had done street outreach as well, and I still liked working in the homeless community, but being out in the community rather than being in the community center.
Sure. Yeah, fair enough.
So you meet new people, you know, you get to meet new people in the parks and that kind of stuff. So being out in the community was a lot of fun. And so I did the encampment for about a year and a half. And then my focus changed a lot to I really want to start focusing on more recovery-based stuff. Right. On a full-time basis. And Smart Recovery was a blessing,
right.
You know, and it was nice to be able to get trained to be a facilitator. And I mean, the group on Thursdays has gone from like 8 people to like 25.
Right. It's amazing. And a really solid group of kind of regulars.
A lot of regulars. Right. And I remember even going to that meeting myself before I was facilitating. There's still a few people that still come to the group.
Right. Yeah.
And it's nice to be able to see people progress as well and change and watch their growth too. And so it was really nice to do that. And then the Women's Recovery Group is my favorite group.
Yeah.
And it's just,
working really with, found your niche there with it. Yeah. With that group work. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, you know, it's just women getting together and connecting, and it's just, I look forward to my Saturdays. It's my Friday, so it's like it's one of the best parts of the week. And
well, it's got to be this, you know, nice on two different sides for you. You know, on one side that you're giving back and that you're, you know, sharing your experience, but then also too for having that opportunity to talk recovery, and it's got to be nice for your recovery as well. Kind of, you know, kind of keep your head in the game.
Yeah, and it's kind of like, I needed balance. That was the biggest thing that I was looking for. It was like I was doing a lot of my full-time role was at our place, meeting people's basic needs and living in recovery every day. Mm-hmm. I was like, you know, I really want to start giving back to people that are wanting recovery too, because there is another way to live.
Right.
And you know, it's great to be able to meet people in the community and, you know, sit across the table from somebody to be that hope that they've lost.
Right.
Right.
So you're now in this outreach role, and that's kind of your between the groups and the outreach, you're being able to talk recovery on a full-time basis.
Yeah.
And help people. And it's got to be a pretty profound experience for you being on the other side of the table now and you know, be able to give that support that you were given, you know, back in the day. And that's got to be I know it's always hard work, and because you're seeing people rise and fall and get discouraged and get empowered. And, you know, it's a wild ride, the life of an outreach worker, but it's got to be incredibly rewarding.
A rewarding job. And, it's kind of like finding your purpose, right? And it's more about what happens in other people doing what I do.
Right.
And I know what it's like to be on both sides of the coin.
Mm.
You know, I see and I can experience the fear around not knowing where to go next,
right,
to being in a place of, you know, working hard to make changes, to not stay there.
Right.
And, you know, and being in a place of no judgment, like everybody's on a journey. It doesn't matter where they are. Mm-hmm. You know, and just sometimes just sitting down and saying hi to somebody makes a person stay, buy them a coffee.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know.
Right. That progress might not be, right. Looks very different every day, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And it's kind of like, you know, you see somebody that's on the, you know, on the street, it's like, you know, like saying hi to them or, you know, throwing a couple of bucks in their little hat or, hey, you know, can I buy you a coffee?
Right.
You know, makes just a big difference to people. It's a get out of the stigma and the judgment, right, and
have a human interaction.
Have a human interaction. And, you know, addiction humbled me.
Right.
You know, it was very, very humbling experience to go through that and to be able to practice humility and
absolutely
recognize that regardless of where I am today, I could very well be there again with right simply a wrong decision.
Right.
Right. And I'm not any better or any less than anybody else out there.
Right.
Yeah. So.
So, I mean, you know, I'll ask this question now, you know, obviously, you know, going through the experience yourself, you know, that you have, and then getting into this role, you've really seen such a cross section of the support, you know, available out there, and you, mm-hmm, someone, you know, when you're on the street level and, you know, you've, well, you know, done the harm reduction approach, you've done recovery groups, you've now doing outreach, you know, I think you're probably one of the best people who could kind of, you know, shed some light on what you see as far as, you know, next steps or, you know, what's working, what's not working in our, you know, current state of affairs right now in our community and, you know, our province. What, you know, what do you see out there as what's needed, you know, to help, you know, obviously we're at a really, really challenging time when it comes to the world of addiction and homelessness and doesn't seem to be getting, you know, better anytime soon. What are your thoughts on that? What, you know, what, is there some missing links that you can see?
Yeah. Honestly, like, you know, I mean, yes. I mean, we're definitely in a housing crisis, you know, which is unfortunate, but I think the biggest thing right now is being able to give people that opportunity to see what different changes can be made for, you know, for our clients or for family members, that no matter how many buildings you put up for harm reduction that are supportive housing and harm reduction, there's still going to be people that are homeless.
Mm.
And what I see is we're treating a symptom to a much bigger problem.
Mm. Okay.
And the drugs and the alcohol and addiction is the end result of unresolved trauma. And until we're able to address a lot of that stuff and the wait times, like the wait times to get in anywhere or people that get accepted into treatment, but then they have nowhere to go afterwards or, you know, bringing people into detox and taking them to stabilization and then going, okay, well, there's nowhere else for you to go. And a lot of these folks get discharged back to the street.
Right.
So we're just re-traumatizing people.
Yeah, and also then discouraging people.
Well, really, yeah.
So these people have, and I always say that, you know, here's someone who has the courage to make a change and going through those steps. We should do everything in our power to ensure that they have that smooth ride. But like you say, yeah, okay, what when those doors aren't open and that those transitions aren't seamless, and all of a sudden they're back into that same environment, you know, and without homelessness or, you know, a really unstable
or back in their
living,
addiction,
right? Yeah,
yeah.
I think that's the hard part. I think that's what the general public doesn't see or understand is, mm-hmm, it's not like you can just say, hey, I want to make a change, I'm, you know, I'm done with this, I'm ready to put in the work. You would think that those opportunities would be there for people, but how, mm-hmm, hard that is to actually access.
And the amount of money that's being put into supportive housing sites, there could be money being put into recovery houses or some sort of housing.
Space.
Yeah, like a sober building.
Right.
Or people that are coming out of treatment, or they don't have a spot at Second Stage, they can go somewhere else. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, you think about the amount of buildings that have been built
mm-hmm.
for supportive housing.
Yeah, and why not take one of those and make that sober? Make it sober. Out of all the buildings that have gone up or that we've acquired as a, you know, province, what couldn't we put one of those
one
to
of
people
them
that
nice,
are wanting
yeah.
to give, you know, sobriety a go, or that are sober, you know? Or
well, we talk about, you know, I mean, especially for myself as an outreach worker. You know, and we're talking about a lot of this, the recovery stuff. And then we have our mental health system that it's discouraging. It's like, why would I want to go through making changes to be in recovery when there's a chance that I might end up being back in a using site or mm-hmm. homeless because I have nowhere to go? And it's like, how discouraging somebody being in a treatment center that's being told you have nowhere to go after you're
right.
done here. You know, the fear God that we're instilling inside. In these people.
Right.
And I just, my heart breaks. And even for myself, you know, so getting sober and staying sober 6 years ago was a lot easier than it is now. And I, right. and I'm like, you know, like you can't go to stabilization unless you go through detox, but you got to wait weeks or months before you can get to detox. But it's right. like you go to detox, there's no chance you get to stabilization.
Right.
So it's kind of like, yeah, I.
You can see why people are, you know, aren't even giving it a shot, right?
Yeah.
They aren't, you know, it's, yeah. That I think that's the hard part is people don't realize that that's a big reason why individuals aren't even making the effort to go is because they might have gone through it a couple times and seen that the support isn't there for them, right?
Well, and that's the thing too is, you know, we need the supports to stay in our recovery and. Mm-hmm. You know, housing's a big thing,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of people that are wanting to make these changes either are unhoused, or precariously housed,
mm-hmm.
Or you know they have a place, but they're on their way of being booted out because of their addiction, and they're trying mm-hmm. to make changes, but it's like they go through detox and stay, and then it's like, where do they go?
Right.
We have, especially for women right now,
right.
we have one
options?
Woman Second Stage house that consists of about six people,
right?
Maybe six or 10, I think. I can't mm-hmm. remember how many beds are in there, but, yeah.
Right. Like for a population our size.
Yeah. And the amount of people coming out of treatment centers right. does not accommodate.
Yeah.
Like the housing doesn't accommodate that.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of the times when I'm putting in treatment referrals, I will suggest, you know, it might be an idea for you to look at the mainland.
Right.
Because there's Second Stage houses over there.
Right.
Where here we have these treatment centers, beautiful, amazing treatment centers, and one Second Stage house for women.
Right.
Like,
so
I'm like, you know, if I was to look at, you know, if I was to take myself into this equation, I would be discouraged to want to do anything recovery based because mm-hmm. all of the work that I'm putting in to make all these changes, I can end up right back in my addiction again because
right.
I'm now surrounded by old behaviors.
Right.
You know,
right.
going through 90 days to be discharged back to Rock Bay Landing is
right.
not setting somebody up for success.
That's right.
And and it's, yeah. I just see so many things, and it's just like you see, like even you know, people are just we're just walking by so many people that are homeless, and it's almost like it's become a routine of just, you know, looking over and oh, okay, they're breathing, they're okay,
they're not,
and it's
right.
like they're not okay.
Right.
These people are sleeping yeah. on the sidewalk.
Yeah.
They're not okay.
Right.
And you know, it's why don't you take them for coffee, or hey, mm-hmm. can I buy you a bagel or something?
Right.
You know, and I see it, you know, a lot, especially downtown, and you know, like just you know, the general community just right. walks by, and it's just like, oh, okay.
Now, every individual has a story, right?
Yeah, you know, and a lot of those folks have amazing stories
absolutely.
To share, and it's
absolutely.
Like let's give them that opportunity to be able to share their story and get it out too.
Yeah, yeah,
you
and I think you know when you do talk to people, and I think that's just that other misconception is that people don't want to get better. I just think that's bullshit. I think there's so many people that want to get better and they're scared to, because they know the landscape out there. And man, if we made that ride smoother and easier, I think we'd have a lot of people jumping at recovery and giving it a shot. You know, if they knew, hey, we're gonna take care of you, we're gonna make sure you stay safe and supported and housed.
Yeah, and I'm gonna help you
in a sober space, and we're gonna provide that support all along the way. I think we'd have tons of people that would have the courage. You know, that would give them that impetus to kind of make that change. But right now, we're definitely giving them a lot of reasons to discourage them from giving that, you know, that attempt.
And it's like, you know, whatever happened to having that conversation? Like, you know, if you were to ask most people down there, like, would you, you know, if you had the opportunity to be housed and not be dependent on substances and have a job and, mm-hmm. and, you know, and all of these things that come with recovery, mm-hmm. it's pretty ignorant to say that these people just don't want to get well.
Right.
It's like, who are we to even make that judgment? Have we had that conversation with them?
Yeah.
And more often than not, a lot of them, you know, I mean, even though I'm in, you know, community outreach working with people that are seeking recovery, I have conversations with people that are not in recovery. And that is a common thing. It's like, what's the point?
Right.
Why would I want to make any change? It's easier to stay here because I know I'm going to end up back here even if I try.
Right.
And, you know, I'm grateful that, you know, our place is opening up, you know, 20 extra female beds. Mm-hmm. Again, where's the second stage house?
Right. Where's the continuum?
The continuum? Yeah. And I think it's great that we have that other option for treatment. You know, treatment centers, you know, with the way things are today, keep people in treatment as long as you can until something changes,
right.
You know? And I know there's some people at Hannah House that have been there for a while because it's like, where are they going to go?
Right. Well, that was always when I was talking to someone, if they were over somewhere, you know, let's say a guy was up at CBRC in Comox Valley and they've got second stage, stay there.
Just stay.
If it's working, just see it through, right? Because we know the longer that you can stay in support, the better your chances, right? So
yeah, and, you know, I mean, and encouraging people that when they're doing the recovery thing, that, it, you know, stay in recovery, like surround yourself with recovery. You know, you go through a 90-day treatment center, you end up back out with nowhere to go other than a shelter. Mm-hmm. These people are not really going to be encouraged to, okay, well, I guess I should go to an AA meeting when the one place that you're sleeping is you're fearing for your life.
Right.
Yep. Am I going to get ripped off? Am I going to get beat up?
Yeah.
You know?
You're not in the right environment.
No, wrong environment to be in. It's not safe. Right. And when we're in recovery and we're working recovery programs and we're surrounded, and that's the biggest thing when you get to a treatment center, it's safety. It's the first thing. It's first and foremost our security.
Right.
There's no security in a homeless shelter.
Right.
Or sleeping on the street.
Yeah.
But that's the biggest piece that's missing.
Yeah. Amazing. I mean, I think I might have to have you back on for another, just talking about the landscape of, you know, our community right now. Cause I think your insight is so invaluable. We're pretty much, we're at the end. This has been a great chat. What a effortless, you know, I just love, you know, I love hearing your story and you just, you know, speak about it so eloquently. I guess one last question, this is a hard one maybe, but you know, someone comes to you and asks you for advice, you know, obviously you are such a role model for women, for everyone, you know, in recovery. What do you say to them? You know, if someone's asking you, you know, what do I do if they're new to the rooms or if they're new to, you know, recovery?
You know, usually when I just, you know, I mean, I can only really speak on my own story, but it's like, you know, when for people that are starting in recovery, it's like, stay in recovery, right. You know, talk to people, go to meetings, you know, reach out and call people, get yourself a little recovery community, people that you can talk to, and, you know, refer them to like recovery organizations. There's umbrella, there's groups, there's things that people can be doing, even if they're on the wait list for a treatment center. Right. Your recovery doesn't have to start when you get into treatment.
Right.
Your recovery can start building now.
That infrastructure and building that support circle.
Yeah, because it's important that when you get out of treatment that you have a community.
Right.
So start building your community now.
Right.
You know, the biggest thing for, you know, the biggest suggestion that was ever made to me is like, go to meetings, go to as many meetings as you can go to. Don't drink in between meetings, do service work, get a sponsor and a home group.
Right.
And it, you know, for somebody that's new in recovery, it sounds like a lot, but it is probably the simplest thing.
Right.
Is to do those things. You just show up.
Right.
And, you know, and be that person, be the greeter at a meeting, be the person that makes coffee,
right.
You know, eventually you'll be able to chair meetings. But keep yourself in recovery, like surround yourself with people. Like I was, you know, the first 2 years that I was sober, it was just meetings, meetings, meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know any different,
mm-hmm.
you know? And what I did know is that what I was doing was working because before it wasn't working,
right. Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And it's not an uncommon thing to stop doing the things that work because we're convinced that we're okay.
Right.
And we are okay as long as we're doing what's keeping us sober.
Right.
And for myself, I just stopped doing all of the stuff that worked. You know, I just was convinced that I can do it for a while and then I don't have to do it anymore. Right. And
so it's that commitment
yeah.
to that change, that
yeah.
lifestyle change.
Right? Yeah. And, you know, it's like, you know, a lot of people in early recovery, and I know for myself, I just felt so lost. You know, and sometimes feeling lost and not really knowing what's next or what's going to happen down the road or where I'm going to go. Sometimes being in that place of not knowing opens up doors to find out what you really want to do with your life.
Right.
You know,
right.
You know, you don't have to have all the answers. I had to have all the answers.
Right.
And I just because I never I was more in tune about why I am the way that I am. And it's like, you know what? Just because I am.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think like other people. I don't react like other people when it comes to alcohol. And the biggest thing was just accepting that this is the way things are. But I mean, the life that I live today in recovery,
right?
I wouldn't change it for anything.
Right.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, listen, thank you so much for coming on. This is great. I've been wanting
thank you so much for asking.
To have you on here for a long time. So I'm really happy. And yeah, like I said, I'm you should be very, really proud of yourself. And we're just so happy to have you on our team and have you such a strong role model in recovery in awesome. Our community. So
yeah. Thanks, Blake. I appreciate great. It. Yeah. I didn't think so much. I was going to do a podcast. I'm actually really happy I did it.
There you go. Oh, I'm so glad. I'm so glad. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Thanks so much again to Steph for coming onto this program. You know, what a profound story of adversity, you know, in her personal journey. And, you know, just really admire the fact that Steph, you know, after 7 months, decided to get in the field and start giving back. That's, you know, 7 months into recovery. It's not a long time, as we all know. And, you know, the passion and compassion that Steph shows towards those suffering with substance use challenges and homelessness challenges, you know, it really is something. And I really feel that Steph's voice and people like Steph, those are the voices we need to hear when we start talking about making changes, because they're the ones who are the best informed and can see it from both sides of the spectrum and can really address where change needs to happen. So I sure hope people can listen to Steph, and I'm, you know, really happy that she had the courage to come on here and not just be vulnerable and share a story, you know, about her personal journey, but just about what she sees out there in the community and the interventions that, you know, are so necessary to start seeing some change. Anyways, couldn't be happier with that conversation. And we will have a couple more podcasts to throw your way. Hopefully it's not going to be another month. Hopefully I can get that out in a couple weeks' time. We're wrapping up. We have two more podcasts before this season wraps up until the fall. But I've been really, really so proud of everybody who have come on, and I really admire the courage to share this message that recovery is possible. And, you know, just takes a lot of dedication and a little bit of luck and some supports and people in your corner. But man, I really need people to know that recovery can happen. We see it every day. And so let's keep pushing for that. From Victoria, BC, my name is Blake Anderson. We'll see you in a couple weeks.